carefully at the bottom of the hole that he had dug. After they were buried, he arranged above them several flat-topped stones in a sequence that he was sure to recognize, and then kicked away his footprints. Papatuanuku, in which, some half-mile downriver from the site of the newly buried gold, Crosby Wells and Taufare are sitting down to a hangi, a meal cooked in a fire pit that was covered in earth, later to be excavated, and the leaves around the meat unwrapped to yield a feast that is moist and richly flavoured with smoke and tannin and the rich, loamy flavours of the soil.
What I'm saying is that there's nothing in it. You with your greenstone, us with our gold. It might just as well be the other way about. The greenstone rushes, we might call them. A green rush, we might say.
Taufare thought about this, still chewing. After a moment, he swallowed and shook his head.
No, he said.
There's no difference, Wells insisted, reaching for another piece of meat. You might not like it, but you have to admit, there's no difference. It's just one mineral or another. One rock or another.
No, Taufare said. He looked angry. It is not the same.
Part 10. Matters of Succession. The 11th of October, 1865. 42 degrees, 43 minutes south, 170 degrees, 58 minutes east. Detriment. In which Anna Wetherill, who remembers the assault that occurred in the boudoir of the House of Many Wishes in Dunedin upon the night of the 12th of May with a stricken, nauseated clarity, and who is made wretched daily by the memory of that assault, a wretchedness not assuaged by the knowledge that her collusion, however tacit, helped an innocent man to escape unharmed, is surprised by the appearance of the disfigured man himself, and in a moment of weakness, forgets herself. Francis Carver was riding inland on the Canyeri Road when he spotted a familiar figure on the roadside. He reined in, dismounted his horse and approached her, perceiving that her walk was unsteady and her face very flushed. She was smiling.
"He got away," she mumbled. "I helped him."
Carver came close. He put his finger beneath her chin and tilted her face.
"Who?"
"Crosby."
Carver stiffened at once.
"Wells," he said. "Where is he?"
She hiccuped. Suddenly she looked frightened.
"Where?"
He pulled back and slapped her hard across the face.
"Answer me. Is he here?"
"No."
"In Otago? Canterbury? Where?"
In desperation, she turned to run. Carver caught her by the shoulder, jerked her back. But just then there came the clap of gunshot nearby.
"Whoa!"
Carver shouted, spinning away, and the horse shied up. Fall, in which Anna Wetherill tells a falsehood to protect Crosby Wells, attempting, in this belated act of loyalty, to atone for an earlier betrayal, the partial memory of which shifts and recedes uncertainly, for her mind has been thrice fogged, once by smoke, a second time by violence, and lastly by the opiate administered by the physician Dr. Gillies, preparatory to a most unhappy procedure, during which Anna sobbed and groaned and clawed herself, becoming so distressed that Dr. Gillies was obliged to ask for help in restraining her, and Lerventhal, ordinarily a man of some fortitude in times of injury or upheaval, wept freely as he pried her hands away. When Anna opened her eyes, Lerventhal was standing over her, a white cloth in one hand, a jar of laudanum in the other. Beside him stood Edgar Clinch, white-faced.
"She's awake," said Clinch.
"Anna," Lerventhal said. "Anna, dear heart."
She said.
"Tell us what happened. Tell us who it was."
"Carver,"
she said thickly.
"Yes,"
said Lerventhal, leaning in. She must not betray Crosby Wells. She had sworn not to betray him. She must not mention his name.
"Carver,"
she said again, her mind focusing, unfocusing.
"Yes?"
"Was the father,"
Anna said. The descendant, in which Emery Staines, learning of Anna's assault from Benjamin Löwenthal, saddles up at once and rides for the Arahura Valley, his jaw set, his eyes pricking tears, these being the external tokens of an emotional disturbance for which he does not, over the course of the journey north, admit true cause, much less attempt to articulate, inasmuch as any powerful emotion can be immediately articulated or understood by the sufferer, who in this case had been so distressed by Löwenthal's frank account of the injuries sustained, and by the blood that soaked his printer's apron from chest to hip, that he forgot both his wallet and his hat at the stables, and as he rode out, almost charged down Harold Nielsen, as the latter exited Tigreen's Hardware with a paper sack beneath his arm. Wells opened his door. There upon the threshold, doubled over, was Emery Staines.
"The baby's gone," he sobbed. "Your baby's gone."
Wells helped him inside and listened to the story. Then he fetched a bottle of brandy, poured them each a glassful, downed it, poured them each another, downed it, poured them a third. When the bottle was empty, Staines said,
"I'll give her half. I'll share it with her. I've a fortune, secret, buried in the ground. I'll dig it up."
Wells stared at him. After a time, he said,
"How much is half?"
"Why," mumbled Staines, "I guess perhaps 2,000.
He put his head down upon the table and closed his eyes. Wells fetched down a tin box from his shelf, opened it, and withdrew a clean sheet of paper and a reservoir pen. He wrote, "On this 11th day of October, 1865, a sum of £2,000 is to be given to Miss Anna Wetherill, formerly of New South Wales, by Mr. Emery Staines, formerly of New South Wales, as witnessed by Mr. Crosby Wells, presiding."
"There," said Wells.
He signed his name and pushed the sheet to Staines.
"Sign."
But the boy was asleep.
Part 11. Orion sets when Scorpio rises. The 3rd of December, 1865. 42 degrees, 43 minutes south, 170 degrees, 58 minutes east. Moon in Taurus. Orion's Reach. In which Anna Wetherill, lost to meditation, tallies her obligations, a project that gives rise to such disconsolation that her mind averts its eye, so to speak,